Now, again, though, why do you think hydroxychloroquine was demonized? Why do you think that it was, especially so early on in Australia? It can't be universal competence across the board. So one of the things that's interesting about ivermectin is it's not demonized worldwide. It's distributed widely in other countries, and it's shown some effectiveness.
Oh, absolutely. You know, ivermectin now is first line in Japan. It's attributed to crushing the curves in Mexico, in Peru, absolutely crushed the curves in India. We've been in close communication with them. Ivermectin is an interesting drug, and I know you've reviewed it in depth on this show. I'll leave it to experts like Dr. Corey and others there. But, you know, I use it every day in my practice. I have no problems with ivermectin. It's safe and effective. There's been a Nobel Prize awarded in 2015 for ivermectin. But hydroxychloroquine, I think worldwide, is still the leading drug used to treat COVID-19 just because of its availability. It's known dosing. The interesting thing between hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin is ivermectin has a range inpatient and outpatient, and has a bigger effect size in general. Both of them are still lacking the 20 to 40,000 patient clinical trial as a singular drug. And I honestly don't think we'll ever get there. By the way, we're in the multi-drug space, so we're never going to go back to single drugs. We're in the multi-drug environment. So there are no large multi-drug trials even planned at this point in time. So we're left with where we are, signals of benefit, acceptable safety. But to finish the thought, ivermectin has a range of effect sizes that are gratifying, inpatient and outpatient, diminishing efficacy later. Hydroxychloroquine has really no support on the inpatient side outside the big Henry Ford study. So hydroxy is largely an outpatient drug. The advantages of hydroxychloroquine are stable dosing, 200 milligrams twice a day. We either go 5, 10, or 30 days. We even have protocols where it's been done that way. Ivermectin, the dosing is 200, 400, or 600 micrograms per kilogram. And the dose intervals still are yet to be standardized or worked out. So it's interesting. So you see an entire range of doses in ivermectin. Mm. Even clinically today, I don't know. Do I go 5 days? Do I do 10 days? Do I do every other day? I don't know. We use the drugs, and I'm comfortable with that. I can live with ambiguity in the setting of a crisis. The point is, these are very safe and effective drugs. They're useful drugs. I saw a trend. You've asked me three times, so I'm going to answer it. I saw a trend starting in April, May, and June, where it became clear that anything we were doing to try to help patients with early treatment was receiving a chill. And the chill was coming through academic institutions, through the medical literature. I think the capper was in June when there was a fraudulent paper published in Lancet on hydroxychloroquine between Harvard and a company called Surgisphere. And this never happens. Lancet's like the New England Journal of Medicine of the world. I'm the editor of a major journal. I run a journal. I know what it takes. There are editors, associate editors, reviewers. There is pinpoint accuracy. We check references. We check plagiarism. Believe me, it's a tight world out there. They basically published a fraudulent paper on hydroxychloroquine in Lancet in 2020, around June. And they let it hang up there for 2 weeks, stating that hydroxychloroquine was associated with harm when used in patients with COVID-19.
Who made this study?
It was between one investigator was at Harvard, and it was by a company called Surgisphere that nobody knew what this company was. It turned out to be a company that literally just dissolved or went away without anybody understanding.
So it was a company that was created specifically to do this.
I don't know. All I can tell you is I looked at the data, Joe, and they had tens of thousands of people they claimed were hospitalized with COVID-19 fairly early in the pandemic. The average age of these people hospitalized was in the low 40s. I looked at this paper in 2 seconds. I go, this doesn't make sense. We were hospitalizing people in their 80s, not in their 40s. And so to me, it didn't look right. And then people started writing Lancet saying, listen, this doesn't look real. And they started receiving tons of emails. And then Lancet basically retracted it and said, we retract it. No apologies, no explanation. I interpret that. And that occurred right before the FDA said, don't use hydroxychloroquine. It almost looked like it was a step to basically try to bury hydroxychloroquine as a therapy.
But why? This is what I still don't understand. What do you think is the motivation, and why was it so worldwide?
As a doctor, all I can tell you is the medical literature as we are seeing it come about. There was once the discovery that the spike protein on the virus the discovery in the medical literature, now that discovery we learned actually occurred years before this, was amenable to neutralization with vaccine-induced antibodies. Once that became abundantly clear in the literature, there appeared to be almost a lockstep developed where people said, uh-huh, that's it. That's the solution. We're going to vaccinate our way out of this problem. We don't even need to worry about how to treat the problem. We don't need to hear about drugs to treat the problem. And the enthusiasm and the hubris for vaccination spread across academic medical centers all over the country.
But what about the people that were currently sick and they were still waiting for the rollout of the vaccine? So if you're talking about August, the vaccine wasn't rolling out for another 4 months. And that's just for elderly people.
I published an op-ed in August of 2020 in The Hill, a Republican journal for Washington people and others in those circles. And the title of the op-ed was The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program. And what I saw is I saw a total shift on everything for the vaccines. Do you know major clinical trials with hydroxychloroquine were dropped? Ivermectin, things were dropped. We had programs for favipiravir. The Canadians had a big thrust for favipiravir. It's dropped. I was the principal investigator overall for the Remetriband program. That was a Japanese product. It was an anticoagulant, antihistamine. It looked very promising. We had great preliminary data. We had Bayer that was going to give us all the doses we needed to treat America. I was on calls between the NIH and the FDA, back and forth, back and forth. I couldn't get any traction in the summer of 2020. It was obvious. In fact, I remember one of the Operation Warp Speed officers telling me, listen, sorry, we have everything organized for the current program. I was also the assistive. I was this kind of second in charge of the Imodulon program, which was a cellular-based vaccine. That was a vaccine similar to the BCG vaccine, which is given for tuberculosis. We had noticed that regions that were vaccinating for tuberculosis, like Haiti and countries in Central Africa, very little COVID. And so we had the idea. We got a Dutch manufacturer to actually make this cellular-based vaccine. We were going to vaccinate healthcare workers. Same thing. Endless proposals between NIH and FDA got nowhere because it looked like it was already pre-decided that the current set of genetic vaccines were going to move forward. There wasn't going to be any discussion on early treatment. I thought it was a gamble. I was faced with more and more of my patients getting sick with COVID-19. And what I told people all over, I said, listen, I can't let the virus slaughter my patients. I'm not going to do it. I said, there's got to be something I could do. Early on, I used hydroxychloroquine, other drugs in combination. Once a Pierre Corey, I give him great credit. His first contribution is actually steroids in the use of COVID-19. So we started using steroids once it was shown to us. We added steroids. The data started coming out, anticoagulants. And that's how I put it together. I'm telling you, Joe, every single one of my high-risk patients I've always treated to prevent hospitalization and death. Of the 800,000 deaths that we are right now, I can tell you to a one, they've received either no or inadequate early treatment.
All of them.
Go look in a table of baseline characteristics of hospitalized patients with COVID-19 and look at what they received before they came to the hospital. Zilch. In fact, there's one paper by Ip and colleagues, last name is spelled IP. It was published from New Jersey early on. And in that paper, back when there was a surge of hydroxychloroquine use in the spring of 2020, 7% of people had received some pre-hospital hydroxychloroquine before they got to the hospital. They had improved survival. Even some pre-hospital treatment really worked. So what happened is when we came up with our treatment protocols, the protocol that I mentioned, it sounds like describing what you received as a treatment. You basically received the McCullough protocol. It's now been copyrighted. Sequenced multi-drug. Once the monoclonal antibodies came in, that became a building block in our program. And we can maybe show the multi-drug protocol on the screen if we can look at it. The point is that any pre-hospital treatment was associated with improved survival because we're taking an edge off viral replication, reducing some of the inflammation, preventing some of the thrombosis. If we let this thing run for 14 days, Joe, the lungs are filling with blood clots. By the time the oxygen saturation goes down, that's not the virus. The Italians showed us through autopsy studies, very courageous autopsy studies, the lungs are filled with microblood clots.
So in your opinion, if your protocol had been established and distributed worldwide, if people had recognized that this is a way to deal with early treatment, you think that the overall number of COVID deaths would have been significantly reduced?
I testified in the U.S. Senate November 19th, 2020. I told Americans under oath that 50% of the lives at that time could have been saved. We were at about 250,000 deaths based on what I knew. I then testified on March 10th, 2021 in the Texas Senate, sworn testimony. I upped that to 85% of the deaths could have been avoided. We know that because we carried out studies. We did one with Proctor here in Dallas-Fort Worth where we demonstrated that even the early primordial protocols before the monoclonal antibodies, when we used drugs in combination, were associated with 85% reductions in hospitalizations and deaths compared to fair comparator groups. In, for death, we used the Tri-County Area and DFW averages age-adjusted. And for hospitalization, we used the Cleveland Clinic calculator, which is a very precise estimate of the risk of hospitalization. Then simultaneously, Derwand and Zelenko showed that from our own New York data, and then Didier Rialt showed it from Marseille, France. So we have three different areas showing early multi-drug therapy as an outpatient works substantially, and we've had a giant loss of life, a giant number, millions and millions of unnecessary hospitalizations. And it seemed to me, and I've told Tucker Carlson and many others, it seems to me early on there was an intentional, very comprehensive suppression of early treatment in order to promote fear, suffering, isolation, hospitalization, and death. And it seemed to be completely organized and intentional in order to create acceptance for and then promote mass vaccination.
So you believe this is a premeditated thing that they were doing. So they realized that in order to get people enthusiastic about taking this vaccine, the best way to do that was to not have a protocol for treatment.
It's not just my idea now. It's completely laid out by the book by Dr. Pam Popper, the book recently published by Peter Bregan, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey. I wrote one of the introductions. Dr. Leaf-Leet and Dr. Vladimir Lysenko wrote the other introductions. These books are basically nonfiction. They have 1,000 citations in the Bregan book showing how it was coordinated and planned. Now Bobby Kennedy has his book out, The Real Anthony Fauci. I'm the most mentioned physician in that book. I can tell you that if you want to find the evidence that Moderna was working on the vaccine before the virus ever emanated out of the lab, if you wanted to find the collusions and the operations between the Gates Foundation and Gavi and CEPI and Pfizer and Moderna and the vaccine manufacturers and the Wuhan lab and the National Institutes of Health and Ralph Baric and University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and how all this was organized, if you want to see the Johns Hopkins planning seminar called the SPARS pandemic in 2017, where they had a symposium. People showed up. They wrote up their symposium findings. They published this. It says it's going to be a coronavirus. It's going to be related to MERS and SARS. It's going to come over here to the United States. It's going to shut down cities and frighten people. There's going to be confusion regarding a drug, hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. And we're going to utilize all that in order to railroad the population into mass vaccination. It's laid out in the Johns Hopkins SPARS pandemic training seminar. The only thing they got wrong was the year. They said it was going to be 2025. Instead, it landed a few years early.